the world, despite efforts to curb or to tackle this issue of earning gaps between men and women, they still persist. They are very strong and very significant in some countries. Also, which I think it's even more important, there is a clear pattern of occupational choices, which are clearly distinguished by gender, with women more concentrated in occupations and professions that require, that are more intensive in languages and what we call soft skills, as opposed to men, which focus more on hard sciences. Question, to what extent these two phenomena can arise from factors related to the school environment or to the way boys and girls are treated differently in the school environment and especially by teachers? My results indicate that boys are too harshly assessed when compared to girls, so girls get like a premium in grade. More than that, girls' edge is larger in language than in math, so teachers are usually more generous to girls in language, which is consistent with that phenomenon of girls focusing more in occupations that require language skills. And also, female teachers are more generous to girls than male teachers. And again, this pattern is more pronounced in later grades. Word of caution, even though I keep in like having like hypotheses, making like conjectures, I have at this point no result on the consequences of this differential grading standards on occupational choices by boys and girls. Some literature on these things, I mean, this is pretty much all of them, I think, are economists. Lavi, Ozad, Lindahl, they all have exercise comparing blind and non-blind scores or teacher opinions versus the scores. D and Figler and Lucas, a series of papers on effects of teacher gender on student learning. Also, this piece is by Godin, Rouse, and Blank, which try to devise very smart identification strategies to find discrimination or not. I'll quickly jump to the results because we don't have much time. So basically, I run the same regression, and here, when you see a positive coefficient, that means that girls get a better score or better grade than boys after controlling, in this case, for proficiency. So this is the raw difference between boys and girls. Usually, girls get better language grades in grade 4. I keep adding controls to my regression, like demographics, socioeconomic status, behavior, which is related to school transfers, also another measure of behavior, which is physical education grades, absenteeism, as reported by the students, effort, they also report how many hours they spend doing homework, whether or not they attend like extra classes and things like that, and also the evaluation method used by the teacher as perceived by the students. And even after throwing lots of controls in my regression, again, the results are still persistent and they're a bit stronger in later grades. So it's pretty much the same picture. Here there's just one thing that it's sort of give me some concern. Once I control for physical education, there's a huge difference in the coefficients that I estimate. So probably, very likely, part of my results can be explained simply by differences in behavior which are not accounted for simply by the physical education grade. Okay? I'm not going to discuss that here, but I have some robustness tests. I sort of construct bounds for my measures, my coefficients in there. Mm-hmm. Unless this problem of measurement error is very critical, this thing should still be zero. But anyway, I'm not going to discuss that here. This happens when I, for different measures of grades and scores, one thing is when I look only at raw grades and scores, the other thing when I standardize them within each classroom, and this one when I'm very sort of agnostic and look only at ranks. I'm not looking at the absolute value of grades and scores, but I look only at how teachers rank students within a class. So these are three different measures of grades and score, and the results are very consistent with each other. The thing is, the fact that this coefficient here, down here, in this DID row, is negative means that this grade inflation for girls is more significant in math, or in language than in math, which means that if girls are treated different than boys, this phenomenon is more pervasive in language than in math. We could reinforce those stereotypes that girls usually do better in soft sciences as opposed to hard science, which apparently is not true. And this is the thing about teachers, or male teachers, or female teachers being more generous to girl students than male teachers. Coefficients here are very small, if significant at all, so I wouldn't make a big case about this. Okay, apparently male teachers and female teachers sort of behave the same way in grading. Mm-hmm. The difference are very tiny. So our result is, this is also far indicated, that teachers are tougher on boys when compared to girls. Girls head is larger in language than in math, which in this case is this relative distortion of signal about relative abilities as compared, like probably causing, this is just a conjecture at this point, causing some distortion in occupational choices for girls. And I wouldn't make a big case about this. The way ahead, what are we planning to go with this? In the future, probably in a couple of years from now, we might be able to get hard information from administrative data or from surveys conducted by the Minister of Education on the National High School Exam. So that's that exit exam from high school. We might be able to see what choices they students make or how they perform when they leave high school. Also, the major choice that they make in university, and also labor market data. We are maybe able to understand what consequences this distortions in grade, even small, can have on occupational choices by boys and girls. Again, new instruments, as Ricardo mentioned, these instruments is to measure behavior in class or these other non-cognitive skills. We're doing like a tremendous effort to develop these instruments and to test them in Brazil or to adapt American instruments or instruments that were developed to other countries to our context. Because these are going to be important controls in our regression. This was a very sort of smart comment. These things could be at the heart of our results. Maybe like a two-month way to something which is clearly could be related to other non-cognitive dimensions. Also, one thing that you might do is this sort of grading experiment in which you have students or having teachers or high school teachers grading fake exams, which are sort of controlled experiment in which you just basically hire a bunch of teachers and say, let's grade exams. So for one teacher, I'll tell, this is an exam written by a girl. And this is information about the girl. This is an exam written by the boy, and this is the picture of this boy. So if you perceive that boy as being black, probably you might adjust your grade. So this is some sort of controlled experiment that you might conduct and might give us harder information about this. And one fundamental question, should grading standards matter in a world of racial agents? So if you're this black kid or this girl and you know that you are discriminated for or against, shouldn't you take that into account and make your decision that if you get like a 10, doesn't mean that you are an excellent student, it just means that you are a girl or sort of, you take that into account and you redo your decisions in order of making grading standards absolutely irrelevant. I think this is what I had to say. Go ahead.
So I have a question about the norm reference and criteria reference. Because grades are usually given normed against a class. You know, think about being a teacher. Mm-hmm. So it depends on, maybe depending on how many girls and boys are in your class. Also depending on, maybe the racial makeup. But still, when you're a teacher, you're assigning grades, maybe a little bit less than the competence base. And then the standardized test you were talking about is a criteria reference test. So it's really about the achievement level of the person, or whatever. So and then that goes with what Dell said about taking other things into consideration. But also, maybe it's possible, because you did the ranking of the boys and girls, maybe for the other racial makeup, you can also rank.
We did that, I didn't show it here, but it's
we have results for only original dimensions, only for percentile ranks, and again the results that the blacks are ranked behind
At the end of the day, if you look at grades carefully, what teachers do with grades, they basically, they're ranking the students. If you look and say, let's get the highest score in the proficiency test across all classes in the system, you see like a tremendous variation, right? You see classes in which most, like 100% of the students are non-proficient, and classes in which, say, 90% of the students are proficient. They have like high scores in the proficiency exam. But probably in almost all the classes, you have a grade 10. So a grade 10 doesn't mean the same thing like here and there. So at the end of the day, what teachers are doing, since they have no guideline, they get basically this 6 slots, like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10, and we basically rank their students in those 6 slots. Only a few students get less than 5, right? And so by probably you looking on only at, say, ranks, only on this ordinal dimension, you can escape this discussion about norm references versus something else.
To me, I think he is telling something pretty consistently across board that they are things related to race
and gender.
In gender, in the teacher's judgment, value judgments, when it's normed within a class for the student.
Yeah, well, that's the way we read this thing up to this point. But again, a word of caution. It could be like attributes that are related to gender or race and that you are not measuring. So those things could be capturing. So probably you're not giving girls a better grade because they are girls, but because they behave better, and my measure of behavior simply is not good enough. It could be. It's also consistent with that.
Which calls for, in the black box, kind of, more of a quality.
And also better instruments to measure things. That's the thing about
qualitative. We want to go qualitative. As a qualitative researcher, I'd be happy to come down.
You're very welcome.
Spend a month or two.
I'm going to have something that I can apply to 5 million students.
Oh, that's a problem.
you have to stay for more than 2 months.
But anyway, if I can get like a small group and do a study for that small group, that works for me too.
We could do multiple case studies. Yeah, this would be, because we really do, it is black box, and these are really interesting, important questions, and there's a lot of why here, or what's happening. So
we should talk more about that.
Oh, we'd love to.
Because I'm not familiar with that. An opportunity to learn something.
Oh, thank you. We have one more question from Dan.
I wonder if there's a problem here with the test, and I guess there's something about the test not discriminating equally well among people who are high ability and low ability. And my concern is the test is basically an equalizer. So let's suppose, I think this isn't even an assumption, girls are a lot better at language and language-related activities than the boys. But when it comes time to taking a standardized test, the boys are pretty good at figuring out which circle to fill in. But if you took those two kids with the same scores and you spent any time with them, you would realize this girl is just a lot more fluent and skillful at using language than this boy, but he managed to get the same score. And I've seen the same thing at work on the other side as a teacher, where I get these girls and young women in my classes, and boy, I swear, they can't do any math. But you put them in front of a test, and they suddenly can do things you never believed they could do. And they've learned test-taking skills that mask, actually, underlying weaknesses in their ability to deal with sort of fairly fundamental things in mathematics, but they figured out ways to get around it. But if you took the girl with that score and the boy with that score and you spent any actual time with them trying to solve problems, you realize this boy really can do the math and can do a lot more than this girl at the same score. So I wonder if there's an underlying problem with using these standardized tests and then arguing from the fact that people had the same scores on the test, that the teacher is somehow wrong in giving you their assessment of what their underlying ability is.
Interesting.
I don't know.
Basically, you're saying that the test doesn't measure the abilities that are should
the
be
test
relevant.
Doesn't discriminate nearly as well as the teacher does.
I agree, but again, this discrepancy is related to gender and race. That's one thing. Unless I have a reason to believe that these things are related also, this sort of these fundamental questions or these fundamental elements that are causing the difference are related to race and gender,
I think are...
Yeah, but that would be my argument, particularly when you're getting into questions of relationship of gender to math and language, that in fact, you could throw out the gender thing. If you just had some underlying instrument that distinguished people who are really high ability from people who are really low ability, you would discover the test does not discriminate as well as it needs
to. Well,
yeah, the only way that you can answer that, if you have blind and non-blind exams that are exactly in the same format. So if I have, teachers grading an exam that's a blind exam, that's not blind, and then I give this, the same students doing the same exam on the same format.
If the teacher doesn't know the student, has no other contact with the student, then that would be true. If you see them giving it.
Yeah, but when I compare blind and non-blind, just results should vanish. Right, because this comes from the structure of the test and not from the identification of the gender. That's what we're saying. So if I compare tests that are identical, but one are blind, so they have the same structure, they have the same design, but one were graded by a teacher that knows the identity of the student, and the other one is graded by a teacher that doesn't know the identity, so all the structural differences should vanish.
Well, I agree completely, but that's a different question than asking whether a classroom teacher was.
That's the only way that I could answer that. But of course, these tests are very different. These exams, they have very different structure.
Are there other exams you could use? For instance, I mean, you guys are testing a lot of different things. One suggestion, we could use here would be for a written portion. Of, for instance, an SAT, as opposed to a standardized fill in the blank. Are there any tests you administer that you could submit blind review that might get beyond the limitations?
We control actually for written tests for the essay.
Because the SARESP has this short essay, like 15 lines that we have to write, and try to short essay about something. Okay. I'm controlling for the score of that. That portion of the test.
I completely agree with you the structure of the test can be causing that. That's so. There is one paper.
Something different than what we think.
Victor Levy actually has a paper where he's comparing two exams that are exactly the same exams. So the same structure, the same design, and one is graded by a machine, which is blind, and the other one is graded by a teacher.
It's basically a test that comes questions come from the same database of items, It's the university admission test in Israel. Like, and a portion of the test is graded by teachers, and they also a week later they take probably the very similar test with
questions taken from the same database. Exactly. So in the same format, and then he finds difference between males and females.
And then if you go, those measuring problems are important enough, and we keep struggling to circumvent the problems. But then if you go to income, and then you have very stable difference between blacks and whites and between men and women, that is far some years later. So maybe there was something during school already that is for sure related to those differences we observe 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road, which is, but we try to measure what we can see at school, right, or in school.
Our interest in your work is measured by the degree of discussion and the number of questions. It's important, it's relevant, and we just thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
It's two very interesting experiences in the São Paulo Secretariat of Education that were adopted. I'd be happy to talk to you if you are interested later on. But last week we had this good news that two of the experiments that you are proposing will probably be funded and will go to the field. So we'd like to get feedback from you because these things are about to happen and you have much more experience in designing and implementing field experiments than we do. So it's very important for us to have your feedback and your feelings about this than about the policy experiment. So what I'm going to do here, I'll go quickly through two experiments. One is about tutoring, and the other one is about an information shock. I'll make that thing clear in 1 second. Well, as I probably have said before, standardized tests show that the level of proficiency in math and reading among Brazilian students is very low. We are doing very bad even compared to other developing countries like us. On top of this low average scores, there is a tremendous amount of heterogeneity within the school system. So if you go to a class in Brazil, probably you'll find like a bright student and a terrible student. And, if you look at schools across schools or across school districts, this thing becomes even worse. So this is like two very important issues that we have to tackle there. One is low average scores, the other is heterogeneity. How to deal with those two things. This is the PISA scores. Here we're looking only comparing scores in reading 2000 and 2006. And Brazil, well, where is Brazil? Well, this thing is not showing everything. It's in the middle?
Very, very far
out. Here we are.
There you are.
There we are. Brazil, you see one of the lowest achievements. In some cases, if you look at 2000, lower than even Argentina, which is really a shame for us. Not Argentina. And if you compare us to Chile, we're doing much worse.
And no improvement.
Yeah, and no improvement over time. If you look at math, I have like Israel here because I made this presentation in the past from Israel, so that's why Israel is here. If you look at math scores, the situation is even worse. Like in 2000, Brazil was the worst performance in the PISA exam. We managed to improve a little bit, but it's still like we are better than Tunisia. So if you compare us like
that's pretty problem because the Middle East is about the most low scoring in the world.
We can be worse than that.
Or than that.
So if Brazil wants to become a developed nation, we have to deal with this. We have to find a way to cope with this problem of low achievement of our students. As I mentioned before, average proficiency has decreased over years, not because our students are worse, but because they are going to school now and are able to test them. So this is school democratization process since the middle 1990s. The students of highly vulnerable environments and backgrounds are attending school now. Like 30 years ago, these students would never be enrolled even in the first grade, or they would drop out like in the third grade. But now, we are managing to keep those students at school, which is good. That solves our quantitative issues. Now these kids are attending school, but they are not learning anything. Just a figure, 95% of all children aged 5 to 14 are enrolled in school, but the vast majority the vast majority of students are in public schools. But as I said, they're not learning much. With this increase in enrollment, that brings some extra problems that we have to deal with. First, age grade distortion is high. So students now are going back to school. Therefore, you have like students in fourth grade that are 12. And they sit in the same classroom with students that are 9 or 10. Low-income parents with low schooling achievement, as Ricardo mentioned earlier today, approximately in Brazil, we calculate this, it's probably 65% of the students now have achieved a level of schooling that's higher than the level of schooling of their parents. So they have nobody at home to resort to help them with problems or how to basically survive in this schooling environment. This creates a challenge not for one generation, but probably for two or three, because these kids are in families that nobody's there to help them. Since students have achieved more in terms of schooling than their parents, parents cannot participate in the learning process because they're simply not familiarized with the school environment. And most of these students did not attend kindergarten or preschool, even though this thing has been changing recently. Preschool enrollment has increased, and Brazil has been able to provide four spots in preschool for students. We need to respond to those challenges. We need to increase average proficiency of our students, and you need to include all of them. So our objective at the end of the day should be to provide like a decent learning environment for most students. And we have to do it with programs that have some special features, because remember, we're a developing country, we don't have a huge amount of resources to spend on education, even though we do spend a lot of money on education. So programs have to be, first of all, effective. They have to increase proficiency and other abilities, like the non-cognitive skills that were mentioned here earlier today. Second, as I mentioned, low cost per student, so you cannot afford expensive programs. Only small changes in existing structures. Interests in Brazil, they are very powerful, and they are very well situated. So if you want to make huge change in the structures, probably there's going to be a lot of opposition. You have to be smart to identify in what margin you can attack and make little changes. So one thing that might be interesting or reasonable to do is to adapt interventions that prove to be successful in other contexts. One thing that we thought of that was a challenge that was posed to us by the representative Paulo Renato, which is now the Secretary of Education of the state of São Paulo, is saying design like a two or three programs that you think are reasonable, that fulfill those criteria that I just mentioned, and let's see what we can do. So one thing that we thought is that is tutoring programs, which basically are some after-school classes in small groups that students take that might help them with specific difficulties that they might have. Why tutor is particularly interesting for Brazil? Because it can make up for the low involvement of parents. Since parents cannot be tutors at home, probably you gotta get another tutor for these kids. Nevertheless, we need to find out what format of tutoring is more appropriate for Brazil. We don't know anything about that.
Fernando, just in the involvement of parents, I think it's important to tell them how many hours the students attend school.
Oh yeah, true. Basic school in Brazil is part-time. So most of these kids go to school from 8 to noon, and they have the whole afternoon free. Or they go to school from 1 to 5 p.m. and that's all. So they spend not as much time in school as their American counterparts.
That means the parents' intervention is more important for them than for a kid that stays in school until 3 or something.
Okay, so what we do now is we design this project that presents alternative formats of tutoring programs, and you propose to evaluate the effectiveness of those alternative formats using a very scientific methodology. At this stage, the most important thing to do is to learn what's more appropriate. The tradition in Brazil is not to conduct experiments, not to mention natural or randomized experience. Usually things in Brazil, like a politician comes up with an idea and that thing is implemented the next day without any sort of trial or adaptation or exercise to learn whether or not that thing is effective. And people are very reluctant to implement programs that use randomized trials, because in that case you need clearly a control group of people that are not enroll in the program. And people usually, like people in public sector, they favor programs that are universal, that leave nobody behind, even like in pilot format. So it's very hard to sell those things. But now we have, as I'll mention later, a very favorable circumstance. We need to have a Secretary of Education that supports this kind of initiative, and you wind up a bunch of private donors that might fund this, because the government cannot fund a program like this. The reasons are simple, it's not universal. Somebody could sue the government and say, okay, I want to be there. And crossovers are nightmare. So what we propose to do, and this is our sales pitch for several people, is to, before implement a program universally. Let's do a pilot stage and implement the program in several formats to try to measure the costs, benefits, risks involved, and try to learn something from that experience to adapt the program later on and have it implemented on a full scale in a much better version. And it's better to learn something in a small scale pilot program than to go ahead and do it like universally and risk the, like wasting a lot of public money. One important thing about this is that we want to measure not only the impact of this of participation in this program on the participants themselves, but also on other family members and peers. So we definitely want to capture some spillover effects into other people. And I'll explain to you very soon how we're going to make that. We measure impact only not only on the tutories, or we call modules, but also on the tutors themselves. We also want to measure gains in non-cognitive aspects, which are very important for, say, labor market outcomes, but usually are forgotten in this kind of evaluation. And this thing has been abandoned recently, so I'm not mentioning.
What was the abandoned?
The power of incentives. We'll give incentives to tutors that their payment would be conditioned on the performance of the tutors.
But that's better.
But given the size of the experiment, that would have to be very big in order for us to capture this thing. So,
and are there incentives for the parents to require?
So what is this tutoring about? Basically, it's 2 90-minute sessions per week according to a predefined schedule. So basically what we do is from August 2010 to November 2010, therefore for 4 months, we have tutors meeting like a small group of students, on average like 3 students per tutor in a small session, very close interaction between them in the school of the students. So basically the school that they usually attend will provide some space, some probably a classroom that's empty, and this group should meet there. And the tutor should primarily work with the students on their math homework. Right? Basically, we have in Brazil, it's something very common for middle and upper classes to have like a private tutor, but you hire, usually your kid is doing well in school, it's falling behind. So basically, what we do, you hire a private tutor, and that private tutor meets the student for like a few times a week to help or her. What you're going to do here, you're going to basically provide a tutor for a small group of students that might be falling behind. And in order for this thing to work, the involvement of the math teacher has to be minimized. Otherwise, this thing is not going to fly. How are we going to select these students or the topos? Basically, we look how well they did in the November 2008 for the 6th graders, and then November 2009, like the last year, this exam for 5th graders. So these are the groups from which you're going to draw our students. 6th and 5th and 6th graders. If you remember what Ricardo said lately, there's a lot of dropouts among 5th graders. It's a tremendous change in the school environment, and some of the students simply cannot make it. They end up dropping out of school. The students that fulfill this criteria that are falling behind according to the SARESP test, which is the official standard for learning and proficiency, they will be invited to participate in the program, take the tutoring sessions. Among those that decide to participate, we will randomly select a group that will be definitely the treated group. And the students that are not selected by our lottery will be in a comparison group.
Should we use the other group too?
Which other group?
The ones that not volunteered for.
But that group is different, right? They probably didn't have like the motivation, or they're probably different. In
that's why you should.
Okay,
also compare them.
Just for sake, I mean, it's in this context, it's easy because all of them are gonna take the SARESP 2010, so they're gonna be there like naturally, with no extra effort. So these guys are all going to take an extra exam or this official exam.
That's interesting because you can understand selection into the program.
Yeah. Totally agree. But I mean, they're not like a valid comparison group ex-ante, but they might be exposed.
If you might find that the control group is different from the test the group, but not so different from the...
Yeah. Agree. We actually have developed these things for other interventions that we are evaluating, but also instruments to gauge non-cognitive abilities. This is not part of the SRS, but you have to run these things by ourselves. How are you going to select the tutors? Tutors are going to be the best students in grade 10 and 11. They are invited to participate. And the criteria is defined by the performance in the SRS 2010. In this case, the same applies for the pupils. Parents have to agree because these candidates are all under 18, which is the age to be legally an adult in Brazil. And then we select tutors randomly for the group of interest. And tutors are going to receive a small stipend to tutor a group of students, which is equivalent to about, say, $2, $150, it's like $60 per month.
$60.
Which is close to what they would receive in the Bolsa Família.
Uh-huh.
And close to what they receive in the labor market if they decide to work. The hourly wage is close to that. Another format of this program, we have, instead of having high school students tutoring elementary school students, we have university or college students, mostly sophomores and juniors, tutoring main tutors. Right? So we basically select them from local colleges and universities, mostly from the fields of math, physics, chemistry, and pedagogy, because these guys are, this tutoring is about math. We advertise the program in local colleges. Students sign up on the internet or send transcripts, and they have to go to HPH and whether or not they have the ability to be tutors. And we randomly select qualified students. The size of our program, approximately we need 800 tutors, 400 from high school students, and 400 are university students. Since we have on average 3 students per tutor, we are talking about 2,400 pupils. This program is going to be fielding 320 schools. 100 will be treated with high school students as tutors, 100 will be treated with college students as tutors, and 120 will be under control. Funding comes from IEDB, the Inter-American Development Bank, and private donors. And the Secretary of Education will provide facilities, the students, administrative records, and extra SRASP exams for classes or for grades that are not usually upgrades. This product has been called by us like the Phoenix.
Phoenix. It's called the Phoenix.
Codename Phoenix. It was born in 2008 and it died a couple of times. But it's very resilient. It feels like this thing had been killed off like 2 months ago. We said, "We are not going to do this. We didn't get the money." But somehow, like people show up and say, "Okay, let's do this thing," and the ball gets rolling.
Yeah, because it's going to be funded by multiple sources.
Yes.
So the IDB is putting some money in and private donors.
Right, good. So it's basically an after school program with a reasoning figure.
Will the payment incentive for the university tutors be exactly the same as the high
school? More?
More. How much more?
It's 175 reais, which is about $100.
Yeah, the way that we calibrate that, we went to the household survey and see how much these people with this qualification were making in order to offer like a competitive hourly wage for these people. So we are offering the wage rate that we are offering is around the 90 percentile of what these people are making.
They're paying transportation costs?
Yes.
Yeah, it includes transportation. I mean, the student is supposed to tutor in a school close to his own school, so transportation costs are have to be minimized in this way.
Sure.
So the idea is that we want to use this heterogeneity within the system in a positive way. So we have bright students and you have like terrible students. We want to put the bright students to teach the terrible students.
And yeah, the interesting thing here is that when we have just high school students cheating for the middle school, the high school students cheating for the tutoring for the middle school students, we expected to have an effect through role model. Right, because these are guys that come from the same neighborhood, from the same, you know, environment, and it's a good student. And we are putting a good student with a bad student, and both of them come from the same environment. So the idea is that these tutoring sections go beyond like just going over math, but talking about how can you survive or how can you be a successful student in that environment. So we have an expectation that the program is can be successful in that dimension through this channel, right? Then there is an interesting thing here that we are, you know, we are putting students together from the same school because the tutoring section are small groups of three students, and we are keeping tracking before the experiment and after the experiment. Information on the students' network, friendship network. So basically each student is invited to name the five, the top five, you know, the fifth close friends that they have, so the top five friends. And there are several personal questions about the relationship with these friends. You know, if you study with these friends, what type of activities you do with these friends. So in that sense, we can also measure spillover effects because we are keeping track of these networks, right? So, and since we are putting exogenously these people together, this is a nice way to measure spillover effects.
Are these sessions monitored as well, like to see if they're concentrating a lot on the material or if there's more dialogue going?
Yeah, for the tutor, for the tutors, you know, they get money for that, and of course they, you know, they get money. They have to show up, like there's a number of times that they have to show up in order to be paid by the end of the month. But in the pupil, in the pupil side, what we are doing is by the end of the program, we are going to make a laptop. So in a draw, and the chances of getting the laptop, the probability of winning the draw, is proportional to the number of times that they show up for tutoring. And we are doing two types of monitoring the presence. There are two ways of measuring. One is the standard way where they're going to sign a sheet and say, okay, we came, so the school is going to keep records of this, their signature. But we know that, you know, they might collude with the school.
Yeah.
You know, these guys never show up. So what we are also doing is something that now it's very popular after the Esther Duflo experiment, is that there is a person in the school that are going to take pictures of these sections. So they're taking pictures of the sections and everybody has to show up. The whole tutoring group has to show up in the pictures. And by the end of the week, they have to submit the pictures to a manager, to the program manager. And then the program manager are going to count the presence using the pictures.
So the sessions aren't scripted, right? It's just the tutor helping with whatever
they're talking
about. Say it again? They're not scripted sessions.
No.
Okay. So don't you think there's going to be perhaps very innovative
thing.
So, is it
still
going to be
comfortable? Like, we might be able to find out what the characteristic of tutors make them more effective. Or characteristics actually of the tutoring group make the tutoring sessions more effective.
But we're talking about 400 groups, right? How many?
800
groups. So
but it's like, if it's a treatment, it's almost
allocating to different kinds of bills to, but it's so you're assessing the effect of any kind of bill, being
the average bill.
The average.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the tutors, they go through any training at all, or is it just sort of?
There will be a very short training session, which
more
is
like
probably going
to be orientation sections that they're going to be told how the program works, all the monitoring stuff, and then they're told that they're not expected to give structured lectures. That's basically they have to go over the math material, so you know they can so. Some strategies are going to be told to them, like, oh, we can go over the math homework, or can just go over the last class, you know, the last, or maybe just can go over, because all the tutors are going to receive the teacher's manual. So they're going to have access to the teacher material, so which is distributed by the state government. So they have access to that material. So what's going to be told them, you know, you can, there are like several types of strategies that you can use, but they are all informal strategies. You know, it's not about have a structural class or a structural teaching, you know, where you, they are supposed to be didactic or something like that. It's more about, you know, in an informal setting, like private tutoring sections, you know, they talk to he's expected to talk to the group of tutors, to the pupils, and ask them what are their, where are they lagging behind, what are their difficulties, and then, you know, in these informal settings, they're going to determine what's going to be the strategy that he's going to adopt to deliver content.
It would be nice to rotate the tutors.
It could be. To what?
It's right. Rotate the tutors.
But the thing is, when they together,
because it's formal,
with
right?
The students, I think that's part of the treatment.
Yeah,
put males with males and females with females?
Yeah, that's an issue.
That's an issue that you're
we don't want to have like female males cheating only female students. So you want to have like
a mixed
compositions on the group of pupils. So at least one student for opposite sex.
And it's also it's sort of
that's the only
loosely supervised by what they call the coordinator teacher at the school. Every school has a coordinator in Brazil, which is like supervise all kinds of things. It's just one more thing that this person will have to supervise.
Now
just to make sure that anything bad doesn't happen.
Right, of course. Now the incentive for the tutors, both the university tutors and the high school tutors, is modest.
It's flat.
And I'm just curious as to what motivates the tutors. If it's not
there is one, yeah, that of course this is a major concern. You want them to comply, or at least to want to participate in the program. We really need here excess of demand, you know, to make a randomized experiment.
Yeah.
So these numbers, there was a program that the state government implemented that was tutoring sections on computer labs, where students, so high school students, were invited to work as teacher assistants in computer labs for 2 hours in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. And the wage rate that was offered for that program was half of the wage rate that we're offering. And more than, there was basically excess of demand of 5 to 1. So for one position.
We are.
All right, so a lot of these tutors, maybe many of them, are not just altruistically motivated. No.
They'll be there for money.
Just like the rest of us. Only
when he's
more
for
yourself. Yeah. Oh, well, give us a time frame for this. When does it begin? When do you think you'll have data available?
I mean, we should check our email because the answer should like.
Yeah.
The secretary now, Paulo Renato, is doing like a fundraising now for this thing.
Yeah, we should get the green light by the end of this week,
and then the
implementation plan is this. The program should go to the field, the sections should start in the first week of August.
I see.
Because
when the semester begins.
When the second semester begins, right? In Brazil we are, so our summers in January, right? So tutoring sections start in August and they finish by the end of the semester. The baseline survey is collected on the schools during the, you know, when they are
sign up
for the program. So when they sign up to the program, together with the form goes like a questionnaire, an instrument goes together. And then in November, they take the standardizing exams. All right, so that's the way it works.
So you'll have first information on output available in November.
Exactly, on November.
You know what would be interesting is to assign another group of students the same tasks the group will deal with without tutoring. So they should do the same homework at home. Because my guess is that usually what students do, they work for half an hour at home and then they go play. So if you give extra work, and my feeling, or just a hypothesis, that if they spent more time studying and doing stuff, they would perform better. So you have the same.
There is a confounding effect here because there are two things happening. It's tutoring sections and time that they're dedicating to studies.
Yeah.
I mean, that's very hard to disentangle because, you know, this is a very informal setting. We don't know exactly how the dynamics of these tutoring sections. So it's really hard to reproduce that without.
But you know they will be for three hours in the week
studying.
Dealing with homework, dealing with something. So if they have the same tasks as homework, so you have like
what's really hard to comply.
That's hard to check compliance. We've got to have the teachers really on board in this case.
Or
because
this,
for this tutoring, you don't need.
Or this
teachers.
Coordinator, you could choose a sample of students that would be assigned those with some incentive, but they would do alone by themselves. Because then we would be testing.
Yeah.
Well, my hypothesis is that
just
the three extra hours studying will make a difference.
Yeah, but the
regardless
way
of
I agree.
But the way that I see that the only way to enforce that these guys are studying for 3 hours
is to have
the tutoring sections.
We contemplated this thing of like having students going to school without a tutor and just sit there and study. We discussed this thing. But I don't think that's doable.
No, but if you require them to deliver the next day something that is. And then this coordinator in the school can receive it and just say, okay.
Yeah, what makes that more complicated is that you need more, so you need more cooperation from the teacher, which might be, you know, we really want to, at least, I mean, we were actually instructed by the secretary that, you know, we cannot, this intervention cannot be like an intervention in class, the teacher. They don't want that.
No.
So that makes it really hard because then I would have to ask the teachers, okay, we have students here that are going to do this exam, are going to do this task in a tutoring group and another ones that are going to do alone by themselves. But then, you know, they have to prepare this section, they have to prepare this material or this material that they're going over. So it's really hard to implement that. But I really understand, I really think that this is we cannot disentangle the time effect of the tutoring.
So what's going to keep the children being tutored coming?
Last question.
Yeah, they want to attend because the more they attend, well, first they signed up for that, right? They decided they want to take
the
tutoring.
Parents or the children.
The children and the parents who got the.
No, they need the authorization of the parents because.
I understand that. But lots of people sign up for lots of things and then they quit.
Yeah.
Attrition is the Achilles heel of virtually every experiment with human subjects. So
and for that, I think 4 months is too long.
My question is, what are you going to do? Do you have anything in place that's going to keep the students coming back? Are you going to discover October, you don't have a sample anymore.
I think that, you know, we are going to draw these computers, these laptops.
Now, the laptops go to whom?
Go to the students.
To the students. And how many are you drawing?
60
laptops.
For 3,200?
Oh, it's great odds.
Yeah. The odds are not so bad.
And your chances depend on your attendance.
Yeah,
so the more you attend, the more points you get, and that counts
more balls
your chance of winning.
But Dale is raising, I think, an important issue, is that if the incentives for continuing are not sufficient, you're going to have a dropout problem.
Yeah.
The issue here is that if the participation constraint is being satisfied, if, you know, if the incentives that you are doing are enough to make these people to participate in the program.
Right.
This is a very hard question to answer ex ante, right? We are doing our best for the tutors. You know, we can look to household survey to see what's the, you know, how much these people are making in the markets. For the pupils, is the only thing that we know is that there was a question in the past about if they have interest in having private tutoring sections. And 15% of the students answered that they would like to have these sections. So that's the only measure that really have that these people are going to look for. Yeah? And on the top of that, we have this, you know, they have a chance of winning a laptop. So, but this is a risk. We know that. And of course, we have a waiting list that are randomized, that, you know, the expectation is that we are going to have a waiting list that is determined randomly. So, you know, as soon, if things that we have this monitoring, if somebody tells us, you know, if the school tells us, oh, this guy is not showing up, we have the next one to go, right? But you are completely right.
So
cannot
you're going to take people off the waiting list throughout the whole experiment?
No, I think that doesn't make a lot of sense, but in the first, month?
Yeah, in the first month, exactly. Not during the program.
But even if you have a mortality rate and you end up with half the sample, still could.
Well, you can answer one question, which is whether putting the program out there for people had an effect, but it won't help you very much to answer the question, was the tutoring per se effective?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No.
But, you know, you can answer what you can answer.
Exactly.
It would seem like you could refocus some of the resources from paying the tutors to providing better incentives. Because you're saying there's that study we used half the, you know, salary when they still had 5-to-1 like for spaces.
Yeah, do this for the tutors.
So wouldn't it it could make sense to reallocate some of those resources going to the salary of the tutors to incentivizing students to stay in by adding more laptops or something like that?
We could do it.
Yeah, I mean, this is a question again about, it's a guess. We have a wide guess. What's the size of the carrier that you have to offer, right? Mm-hmm. We believe that 6 laptops is enough. But, you know, it might be wrong. I mean,
but wouldn't you want to err on the side of keeping student attrition down?
Yeah, there are two things here. You don't want, you know, just laptops is not something very cheap. So you want to make the program cost effective on one side, right? I cannot offer one laptop for every kid. So, you know, by the end of the day, there is a trade-off here. If I put too much incentive, the program just become, you know, too expensive and it's not worth it.
This thing turns out we expect this to become public policy.
Right.
Become universal, then the state of São Paulo would start to offer tutoring sessions for students that have been trouble learning things. So it has to be cost effective.
There's a recent experiment you probably know about, Roland Breyer's experiment in the US. And the interesting result from that was that the rewards mattered if they were very quickly given. So that students didn't respond to a test score going up and getting a reward at the end. And they didn't respond to in-kind rewards. They responded to cash, and cash given immediately.
Quick.
So I was wondering whether you thought about, it didn't have to be a lot of cash. I mean, the cash given could be less than the kind given. But just give them a little reward every day for showing up, so they could go to a movie.
And to some extent, we do that. If like tutors skip a session, that's discounted for their payment. So you're planning to do part of it, but
yeah, in the pupil side,
incentivize
in the pupil side, one thing that you can do is to stagger the draws. So you start drawing the first computer after the first 2 weeks, then you draw the computer in the next. So you know they have the feeling that they are, at any moment they might get the laptop. The problem is, the ones that get the laptop the first time,
forget it.
No, you want to deliver it at the end.
Yeah,
so
but
they want it, but they don't touch it.
You don't get a plug.
The other one. The other thing is that you have 60 guys to loop, you know, you have only 60 laptops and lots of sections, so, you know, 60 is a number that you can afford to lose. So.
I think Kathy's suggestion, though, please think about it, it has to do with the timing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a very good point.
We should try and think of ways of accumulating points. It will be hardly difficult to operate cash, and culturally it will be a very rough thing to do with
schools.
Well,
there are many incentives, cash being only one of them, but the issue here is the immediacy of their delivery.
I think they should receive some fake money, some fake vouchers or something that...
For high school
when students. I used to go to church before First Communion. I had to do it for 2 years and we had points. I mean, you had cards and then you exchange 5 1-points to 1 5-points and then, I mean, maybe something like this.
Something that you might do is like to give cell phone credits for prepaid cell phone.
There's an idea.
Yeah, the thing that I really think that this works for high school.
Is that impossible to do if this program is universal? That's not a question.
Well, we are measuring the pedagogical results. You are not designing the policy. For designing the policy later on, then you have
to... No, but I want to test something that might become policy right away. It's a terrible trick.